The reading today is taken from Daniel 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisers, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisers, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you are commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes of all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. And if you do not worship it, you'll be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves for you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the burning, blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, "Were there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
There's an old fable that has been passed down from generations to generations. It talks about an old man who was traveling with a boy and a donkey. As they walked through a village, the man was leading the donkey and the boy was walking behind the donkey. The townspeople said the old man was a fool for not riding, so to please them, he climbed upon the animal's back. When they came to the next village, the people said the old man was cruel to let the child walk while he enjoyed the ride. So to please them, he got off and set the boy on the animal's back and continued on his way. In the third village, people accused the child of being lazy for making the old man walk, and the suggestion was made that they both ride. So the man climbed on and they set off again. In the fourth village, the townspeople were indignant at the cruelty to the donkey because he was made to carry two people. The frustrated man was last seen carrying the donkey down the road. Now we can smile at that. But you know, there is an element of truth in that, that sometimes it's difficult for us to work through in our own individual lives. Because everyone sitting here, to some extent, is influenced by their peers. And there are times where all of us, whether we recognize it or not, bow down to peer pressure. Sometimes it's for fear of not wanting to be embarrassed. Sometimes it's because we want to be liked by everyone or accepted by everyone. And so it's easier just to go with the flow than to stand up and oppose it. Sometimes we respond to peer pressure by silence, where there's a conversation that we should enter into, but because of the nature of that conversation, it's easier just to keep quiet. Sometimes we respond to cultural pressure, where our culture tells us to behave in a particular way, and in order to conform with that culture, we blend into that culture and we operate according to its norms. Even when sometimes those norms may not, in fact, have a solid foundation or biblical base. Sometimes we respond to peer pressure when we're in a discussion group and where perhaps someone has said something in a Bible study group that maybe is a little bit suspect theologically, but we don't offend them or hurt them or say anything that would cause them, you know, to be upset. And so we just kind of keep quiet and there's this uncomfortable silence. Sometimes we respond to peer pressure when we're in a situation of a church meeting, for example, and the nature of the discussion is going in a particular way, and we want to say something that is contrary to that discussion, but because it seems as though we will be the odd person out, we kind of sit there and we keep quiet. We don't say anything. Now, all of us, at some level, have experienced peer pressure, and the situation here is extreme. And in spite of the pressure that is applied, the wonderfully encouraging thing from this particular story is that God gives them the grace not to bow. They stare Nebuchadnezzar in the face and they say, "We will not bow." These are three men who have deep convictions, and those convictions are not merely a lip service they give, but in fact are the convictions that are lived out under the most extreme circumstances. And therein lies a wonderful challenge for us as God's people, doesn't it? To stand and to ensure that the convictions we hold on the Word of God are not compromised, whether it's by silence or whether it's simply by responding to the crowd. And that, quite frankly, is easier said than done. And it's particularly difficult for younger people. Firstly, I want you to notice the pressure they faced, verses 1 through to 7. The pressure they faced. The scenario is obvious. Nebuchadnezzar, in spite of what's happened previously, where Daniel has interpreted a dream and he's acknowledged God, there is a sense in which Nebuchadnezzar gives lip service to who God is, but when push comes to shove, he goes back on the so-called lip service he gives. And we will see this develop until finally God humbles him to the point where there's true change, and that takes 7 years of him being rendered like an animal. But at this point, he sets up a statue. It's 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. It's a bit of a grotesque when you work out its dimensions, but it's huge. And his command is simple: worship or die. And the pressure faced by these three young men is in the context of all the officials and all the nation and all the other Jews who are in the nation bowing down to this idol when the music is played. Now, in order to compel obedience, Nebuchadnezzar builds a fire. Now, the shape of the fire, probably from the ancient records we have, looks like the old-fashioned milk bottle. Now, some of you who are younger might not know what I'm talking about. But those of you who grew up, I grew up in a country where, I don't know if it was like this in Australia, you can nod your head or tell me it wasn't, but we used to get milk delivered. And you'd have coupons, and you'd put the coupons out, and then the milkman would come, and you would deliver the milk at your house, and you would take it up inside. And the shape of the bottle was a kind of a narrow top, and then it went out like that. So it sort of was that kind of a shape. That's what the furnace was like, with a little door at the bottom. And obviously, it was built in such a way that you could see into the furnace from where King Nebuchadnezzar was observing, and the top was where the smoke would obviously come out, and where they would chuck in the iron ore that they would smelt. The furnace is probably at around about 1,000 degrees Celsius. That's its heat. So you can imagine now when he turns up the heat a little later, that he gets it even hotter than what it is normally at. And so here is a situation where everyone is bowing down and the pressure exerted upon these young men is to comply. And it's easy for us at a distance, because we know the end of the story, to kind of minimize that kind of intense scrutinization that they were under. But I wonder what you and I would do if faced with certain death in a horrible way like that. If there you stood in front and there was a fire raging, and your choice was bow down to the idol, apostatize, or be burned to death. Peer pressure is a very real thing that we have to cope with. And Scripture gives us incidences of where people did not resist. So, for example, remember in Genesis, I'm not going to read the whole thing, where Joseph comes to his brothers and they hatch a plan to kill him. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan, picking up verse 18 in 37, Genesis. But they saw him at a distance. Before they reached him, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we will see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he says. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from him, take him back to his father. But in the end of the day, he doesn't rescue him. Or take Aaron and Moses. And the people saw that Moses was gone for a long time from the mountain. They gathered around to Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him." Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives and your sons and your daughters are wearing. Bring them to me." And so all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took them, they handed it, made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashion it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of Egypt." Here is Aaron, Moses' right-hand man. Moses is gone, and Aaron just says, "Let's make an idol." He succumbs to peer pressure. So let me ask you, when you have a chance to stand on your convictions, even though it's going to cost you, do you stand? Maybe there's an ethical issue at work and there's a discussion around gender reassignment, same-sex marriage, abortion. Do you stand up and proclaim what God says, or do you just silently listen to the discussion? Maybe there's a loophole in the taxes that someone has shown you and everyone's doing it. This is a loophole that pressurizes you to take it. Maybe it's in your parenting, pressurized by secular society to conform to the way in which parenting occurs today. Spare the rod and spoil the child, says Scripture. Well, we don't use the rod because, you know, psychologists tell us that it does tremendous harm. Well, who are you going to believe, the psychologists or the Bible? And we conform to societal standards. What about the way sometimes we may dress? It's fashionable, after all. I've heard that many times. This is the latest fashion, even though there may be immodesty associated with it. Don't tell me how I should or shouldn't dress. It's my right. Perhaps we get pressured into participating in a juicy morsel of gossip. I heard something quite disturbing this week. I won't say what it was, but about how gossip can occur in a church context and undermine the work of the gospel because our preferences aren't being met. Secondly, I want you to notice the conviction they affirmed, verses 8 to 21. The conviction they affirmed. I won't read the verses for the sake of time. having been exposed, they're brought before the king. They're given an opportunity to recant. The king says to them, okay, this is what I've heard. Now, what we see in the story is that these astrologers, these king's officials, they are the elite of the elite. In fact, the word that is used in the original talks about them almost being like a master race. They consider themselves better than everyone else, and they bring these men before the king, who he has elevated to certain positions of power and has appreciated what they've done, and they try and expose them in front of the king, and the king gives them an opportunity to bow down to the idol. Now, what I want to do is just take a few moments, even though this isn't directly in the text, and I understand that, I want to try and draw out some implications of the scenario that they face for us to think through that we might use in our own minds of ways of trying to sometimes reasonably explain our way out of situations when we are under significant pressure. They may have reasoned that they were in a foreign land. And since they're in a foreign land, you adopt the customs of that foreign land. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. And so this has just been part of being absorbed into the culture, and we're simply complying with the culture. And yet there are times as believers where the culture is going to ask us to do things that are contrary to Scripture. And at that point, we must resist the inroads of culture and not simply allow our culture to dominate. There is, in a sense, in the Christian community, a Christian culture. And that Christian culture that we have is a culture that is bound up with the Word of God. And that should always supersede any other culture that we are in. Always. They may have said they had official duties. And so this was part of their official duties. They could take their religious duties, which were private, that they did in the privacy of their own home, and they could continue to worship God in private. But here in the public, since they were part of the official of that land, that they could just simply follow the procedures of fulfilling their official duties and bow down. They may have put their prosperity above their convictions. No sense losing all this prosperity that we're enjoying. You know, I had a conversation with a pastor at the Baptist Union Assembly. We were chatting about church and COVID and how it's affected churches, and how sometimes it's been difficult for churches to know how to navigate through COVID, particularly when it comes to the singing and when to sing and when not to sing and so on. One of the things he said to me, Ian, he said, I've come to see that we are more concerned about our financial well-being, about our comfort, than we are about God and His Word and the convictions that arise out of His Word. And while that may be true of some, I know it's not true of everyone, there is a sense in which it's very easy to be drawn into the, as long as we financially secure, we're okay. And as long as there's nothing that threatens that, we're okay. And we won't do anything that might expose us to being threatened for our financial security. And so we might just keep quiet on certain issues, because that way we won't suffer loss of job. They may have simply said, well, everyone else is doing it. I mean, all the other Jews were bowing down. If they're bowing down, what's the big deal? They may have reasoned, you know, we'll bow down externally, but our hearts are not going to bow down. You know, in our hearts, we will still worship God. So we will just do it as an external means of bowing down and pretending that we worship with an idol, when in fact our hearts are not worshiping, we're worshiping God. But that would have been hypocritical, and it would have caused them to lose their witness. It would have meant that there's this dichotomy between what we do in the public arena and what we do in the private arena. So what we do in the public arena might contradict our faith, and it doesn't really matter as long as we are okay in the private arena. Now, I saw this on a rugby field. I know some of you couldn't care less about rugby, and I understand that, so just bear with me. But I saw this actually happen on a rugby field, where there was a player after a World Cup final who, throughout the game, you know, you can see what the players are saying. It's not difficult when things happen to see some of the language that comes out of their mouth. I mean, you don't have to be a lip reader to know what they're saying. And this player had, at a certain point in the game, it was quite obvious, and you could sometimes overhear it on the mic of the ref, and sometimes they forget to turn it down, where he had used terribly foul language. And then at the end of the match, he points to heaven and he gets down on his knees and he prays. What's going on there? It's okay to use foul language at this point, but at this point we worship. There's a contradiction there. And these men could have done that. Just said, well, look, we're going to bow down now and it's not going to really matter, but not in our hearts. But they didn't. No. They stood and they affirmed their faith. And what I want you to see in the affirming of their faith is they affirm it with the possibility that they're going to die. So in effect, they say to the king, we know that God can rescue us. The issue is not God's power to protect us. We don't know whether God is going to rescue us, because we don't presume upon God. We don't think that God is obliged or under some kind of compulsion to have to rescue us. Just because we are Christians doesn't mean that we are not subject to suffering or pain or dying for our faith. They understand that, and that's very, very commendable, because there is sometimes this teaching that is in certain Christian communities, certainly not in this one, but that kind of says, well, Christians aren't meant to suffer and aren't meant to go through difficult times and are just meant to have a nice, cushy, easy, comfortable, pain-free, suffering-free life. And yet these men recognize that's not true. If you throw us into the fire, God may not protect us. We may die. Notice what else they don't do. They don't try and defend their faith. It's not as if they have to explain the faith to God, about God to these people, and try and defend God. God doesn't need defending. He's God. And so they're willing just to make a statement and say, our God can rescue us, but if he doesn't, we want you to know we won't bow. We will worship God in spite of the threat of impending death. They don't try and justify themselves. They just took a stand. They were men who weren't just men of conviction by lip service. They were men of conviction by action. And therein lies a wonderful lesson for us, that our conviction should not be swayed by the pressure we face in whatever form it is being exerted upon us. And we should understand that if that means in some sense suffering because of those convictions, we should be willing at least to suffer. It may not be that we will suffer, but if we do suffer, we shouldn't complain or feel that somehow we are being done in as a result of our suffering. These men were willing to die for their faith. Does not Jesus say to his disciples in Matthew 16 verse 24, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. And for them, in that context, when Jesus says take up your cross daily, that means that every single day they put themselves in the position where they may lose their lives as a result of following Jesus. You see, for us sitting in comfortable Australia, it's not going to happen, is it? I mean, again, I don't know anyone who's been martyred for their faith in Australia. And if you do, tell me about it, because I don't know anyone who's been martyred, anyone who's been put to death. There is no death penalty here. You may end up going to prison, but you're not going to lose your life for your faith. But you may lose your reputation. You may lose some friends. You may become unpopular at work. You may become unpopular when you're standing on the sidelines with your friends watching your children play sport because of your beliefs. You may become ostracized. People might avoid you because they know that you're a Christian and not engage with you. They may label you as a little bit strange, a little bit weird. They may talk behind your back and gossip about you and say all kinds of things that are nasty when you're not around with their peers because of your stand. As Paul writes to Timothy, he says, if anyone wants to live a godly life, they will be persecuted. It's inevitable. But what you see in the story is that God enables them to stand. It's not as if they have to draw on their own strength. It's not as if they have to drum up some kind of strength they don't possess in order to make this stand. But it is rather drawing on the grace of God, standing as they stand on His word, knowing that if it means certain death in that fire, God will give them the right kind of grace to endure the death that may lay ahead as they are thrown into their fire. They have no question mark about that. There's no doubt about that. They understand that as horrible as it looks and it sounds, that God is not going to abandon them. God is not going to somehow disappear from the scene and say to them, you're on your own now. You have to endure this all by yourself. But God enables them to do what they do. And so they can look at that fire that the king and his anger and his frustration begins to heat up more and more until it gets 7 times hotter than what it should have been. Now, there's obviously a limit to which the heat can go, and it's not meant to be understood literally. It's meant to be understood that he tries to throw as much fuel onto the fire to get it as hot as he's able to get it, because he's so angry. And as they look at that fire, there's not a moment at which they waver in their commitment to Jesus. I mean, that's incredible. Because these are men of conviction. These are men who won't bow, not for anything. These are men that will only worship God and God alone. They won't allow themselves to be sidetracked. They won't allow themselves to be pushed. But they will stand, cost what it will. There have been many, many, many martyrs over the years. I remember our principal picking up, telling us a story when he fetched Richard Wurmbrand from Romania. Richard Wurmbrand spent about 13, 14 years in a Romanian prison. He was beaten. They put hot irons on him. He took his shirt off at one point to show the scars he had from the burning. His life came in with a whisper of dying, languishing in that prison cell. And as Rex, our principal, picked up Richard and took him from the airport back to his home, because he had come to South Africa on a speaking engagement, Rex turned to him in the car and said to him, you know, Richard, I don't know if I could have endured what you endured. I don't know if I could have had the strength to do what you did. I fear that had I been faced with the same kind of torture you were faced with in that prison, that I might have given up my faith. And Richard turned to him and said, don't be silly, Rex. God would have given you the right kind of grace to endure. Do you see, that's it, my dear friends. When you stand and you face those situations, you never face them alone, ever. God is on your side. And God's strength is infinite. That same strength that raised Jesus from the dead is the strength that God gives to you to stand. History, tradition tells us that 11 out of the 12 disciples were martyred. We had friends in the first church we passed in Australia who had an uncle martyred, burnt to death with his two young children in India in a motor car. I talked to his wife when she came to the church after that incident, and his daughter, who wasn't in the car at the time. Horrible death. But God enabled them to endure. Thirdly, the deliverance they experienced. Verses 22 to 30. The deliverance they experienced. Ultimately, this is a battle between God and this idol. And what, again, I want you to understand here is that God is sovereign over every situation. I know you know that. But sometimes we don't always work that out in our circumstances. And there is a sense in which we can understand or take from this passage that God is able to supernaturally intervene in your circumstances, no matter how extreme they may be, and no matter how threatening they may become, and He is quite capable of delivering you in difficult situations. God hasn't changed. It's not as if the God of the Old Testament has suddenly morphed into a new God in the New Testament and somehow that God has changed. The God of the Old Testament is the same as the God of the New Testament. And the God of the Old Testament that is rescued from time to time and intervened supernaturally into the realm of this world and sometimes protected His people and sometimes spared them certain death and spared them suffering and torture is able to do the same to you today. Whether or not God does that, that's up to Him. That's why I began by saying God is sovereign. Sometimes God chooses to intervene, as He does in this situation. King Nebuchadnezzar looks in, and he's the only one who sees it. That's why he turns to his officials, and he says to them, "Can you see a fourth man in there?" And the fourth man, though we are not absolutely certain, more than likely is a pre-incarnate Christ who's in there with them in that furnace, protecting them, and He calls them to come out. They come out. They don't even smell of smoke. That's incredible. Stand around a barbecue and what happens? You end up smelling a bit of smoke. Build a little fire and have a little fire and sit around that fire. And what happens? Your clothes become saturated with the smell of smoke. They walk out and there's not even a smell of smoke on their clothes. It's an absolute miracle. And we must never forget, my dear friends, that God is still a miracle working God. He can still intervene and work miracles in your life. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. And we should never limit God to our small view. Never put God in a box and think that God is somehow locked into that box and can't move outside of the boundaries that sometimes you and I place upon Him. God is able to do miraculous things and He's able to deliver us from the most desperate of situations. Whether it's a deep depression that you may be in. Whether it's a physical ailment that you might be struggling with. Whether it's a financial crisis that you may be facing, whether it's a relationship problem, God is able to intervene in a supernatural way and deliver. That's the kind of God He is. And we should never underestimate His power and His miracle working power. How many of you remember Marjorie Deasy? Remember Marjorie Deasy? Marjorie Deasy was a lady, for those of you who don't know, who came to this church, a missionary, spent many, many years in PNG as a missionary. And she came back, I don't know, how long was she there? About 40 years or 40 or 50 years? It was a long time. And she came back to this church. I met her in her 90s. And if you remember, she died at 99. In her book, She wrote a book, and I can't remember the title as I stand on my feet. Anyone remember the title of the book she wrote? It's something like God Can Do Anything or something like that. Anyway, This is from the book. One particular incident stands out in my memory as Nasser was growing up. This is one of the young men in the tribe. At the time, he was still in primary school. Dudley and I were, Dudley and I were sitting down having lunch when Nasser came up the stairs. In a scared voice, he said, "I've just been bitten by a death adder." He was a very bright pupil and we thought that he was joking, but he said, "Oh no, I'm not joking." So we sat him down beside the table. We looked at his ankle where that snake had bitten him. There was some blood trickling down onto his foot and two very distinct puncture marks. While I went to get my homeopathic medicine, Dudley went down to have a look and see if the death adder was still under the coconut tree. Sure enough, it was still coiled up in the grass, so Dudley killed it. Don't do that in Australia, you get a $90,000 fine. Prior to this incident, everybody who had been bitten by a snake had died. Hear that? Everyone who had been bitten by a snake had died. So little Nasser was terrified and feared that he might die. We sat beside him and said, "Now Nasser, we are going to trust God to bring you through safely. Don't fear, you just keep believing that God will save you." Never say I can't. That's the title of the book. Never say I can't. We had to keep the people away from the house so that there would be no publicity about what had happened. He sat down quietly and we watched carefully. He had no sign of any adverse effects. And after about 3 hours, he got up and left. He went outside and told the people that he had been bitten by a death adder. They would not believe him, so they came to us for confirmation. We told him that he was telling the truth, showed them the snake, and told them how God had saved his life. It's very easy to say, "Well, that only happens in PNG. It doesn't happen in Australia." But it does happen in Australia. God is still able to work a miracle in your life. What is the miracle you're looking for? The issue is not whether or not God can do it. It's whether or not we trust Him. Whether or not we lay it at the foot of the cross. Whether or not we hand it over. And whether or not we just say, "Lord, I can't anymore, but you can. This is impossible as far as I can see, but you're the God of the impossible." Luke 1:37, nothing is impossible with God. God raised from the dead Jesus Christ. That was impossible, but God did it. And God can do anything according to His sovereign plans and purposes for your life. And this story is proof of that. A miracle working God. What's the miracle you're looking for? Will you trust God?